Good morning. We're going to call the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee meeting to order. Do I have a motion on the minutes from our last meeting?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pugh. Representative Pugh moves the minutes from February 24th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Same sign for opposed. Minutes are adopted from our last meeting. Morning, members. We have a few bills on the agenda today, and we're going to start with House File 417. Chair Davids, your bill. Let me just make sure I have the proper motion. You get to go straight to the floor, Mr. Chair. I'll move House File 417 to the General Register. Mr. Chair, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's very good to be before the GovOps Committee today. All this bill does is instead of for the County Economic Development Authority, we're talking about Houston County here, they have 6-year staggered terms, and this bill would allow Houston County to provide a staggered 3-year term. And the very simple reason for this bill is they're having quite a time, a tough time, getting folks to serve on a 6-year term. Now, I would accept a friendly amendment to this bill, Mr. Chairman, to have Minnesota House seats go to a 6-year term. But it's very tough in recruiting for the EDA to go to 6. So this simply takes it from 6 years down to 3 years. So they feel that they could have a easier time recruiting members to serve on the EDA if they didn't have such long-term commitments, Mr. Chairman. And that's the bill. And I don't know of anybody that's really for it or anybody that's really against it. It's just a fine piece of legislation. I appreciate your support.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do have a member question. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, question I have on the 3-year term staggered, there are going to be 3-year staggered terms. Is that they're going to be one up every year, or are they going to be 2 years? Every 2 years there's going to be an election? How is the mechanics that going to run? I mean, and coming from my local union background, we had trustees, and they had staggered terms, and so every year one was up for election. So is this going to add to the cost of the elections for the county?
Chair Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to go over to Mark Shepard, if I could, or Ms. Dyson. I believe that it's phased in. I don't think any terms get cut off. Maybe Ms. Dyson could.
Ms. Dyson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, the bill doesn't specify that one way or another. It just says by resolution, so that it would be up to the county board to make the transition, but under statute, the six-member boards, it's phased in the same way. So with every 2 years, somebody is up, or two people are up. But it's not an election issue, though. I think it's an appointment.
I think, Mr. Chairman, I think that's
Chair Davids.
I don't think we have elections involved here.
So, Mr.
Representative Chair. Nelson.
So, yeah, okay. I was wishing to bring you their appointments, so that would put a cost on it. But so, as they're phased in, then I would assume they'd probably every year have somebody up, and so that or however they work it. So, anyway, that's my question. Just the mechanics of how they plan on working this out.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to Representative Nelson. As this bill moves along, I can get that locked down better for you and get back to you on just how they do that. Because from what I understand, they're not going to be cutting any terms off or anything, but they'll just let them phase out and come in with 3-year terms instead of 6. But I will get back to you on that.
Any other member questions? Seeing none, anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? Seeing none, Mr. Chair, any closing comments?
I'd appreciate your support, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Chair Davids. I will renew my motion. The House File 417 be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? House File 417 is moving to the General Register. Thank you,
Thank
Chair
you,
Davids.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you very much.
I don't see Chair Erdahl in the room.
Oh, yeah, you do.
Yeah, I do. Hiding. There you are. Welcome. Welcome, Chair Erdahl, to the Government Operations Committee. You have House File 1078, and I will move that House File 1078 be referred to State Government Finance.
Thank you.
The Representative David was drooling, or somebody spilled water here.
We must have made him sweat.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. It's always a pleasure to make my weekly appearance here. Hopefully we can move a little quicker than last time, although I do appreciate the fine hearing we had last week. See, first, I believe we have an amendment or two to consider. The first is the A1, which is mine, if someone would care to move that.
I'll move your A1, put it before the committee as an author's amendment, put it in the shape that you would like.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And what this does, it changes the FTE time from 7.5 to 15 for a staff person to administer the fund. And the second part of the amendment deals with the requirement to do a report to the chairs and ranking minority members on basically how this accommodation is working.
With that, we'll move to a vote to put the bill in the shape that the author would like. All in favor of the A1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A1 is adopted.
And then, Mr. Chair, there is another amendment, and you might as well take it at this time if you're so disposed.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I have the A2 amendment, and I would like to move that at this time.
Representative Pugh, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, what my amendment does is it just changes the funding structure for this bill, and it's based on the fact that the governor has directed agencies to have a 7% percentage of their employees with disabilities to be employed by the agencies by 2018, and in fact we're at about 4.7% right now. So what this does is it allocates on a prorated basis the funding into a separate account from which an agency could draw or be reimbursed, replenished, whatever the verbiage would be. Really offering, I think, an incentive to hire an employee with disabilities. So that's the gist of my amendment.
Thank you, Representative Pugh. Chair Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Pugh. I would accept that amendment.
Any further discussion from members on the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the A2, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The A2 is adopted. Those are the only amendments we have in our packets, Chair Erdahl. So to your House file as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1078 creates a central accommodation fund within state government to tap into pay accommodations for job applicants and employees with disabilities, such as special desks, screen reading software, or sign language interpreters. These are some of the accommodations. It removes disincentives for hiring managers to hire workers with disabilities due to the impact of paying for reasonable accommodations out of their division's budgets. There can be reluctance to hire people with disabilities without a funding source. If funds are tight, there may be hesitation to hire such people if money to accommodate their needs is not available. Also, if someone develops a disability, such as a sight or hearing disability, during the course of their employment, they might be reluctant to seek help, knowing money is not available. This bill creates a fund to address these needs of our workforce. And I have Beth Fraser with me to supplement the testimony.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Fraser. If you would introduce yourself for the record and let us know who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Beth Fraser. I'm the Government Relations Director with the Commission of Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. And we are one of the many disability groups that is promoting this legislation, looking for the creation of a central fund for state agencies to tap into. This is an industry best practice that we believe the state of Minnesota should adopt. I know that there are a couple other people that are planning to testify, and I'd prefer to supplement their testimony, or they have much more in-depth knowledge.
Thank you, Ms. Frazier. Mm-hmm. If those that are wishing to testify on the bill would make their way to the testifier table. Welcome to the committee. If you would, just introduce yourself for the record and let us know who you represent.
Good morning. I'm Bobby Cordano, and I am the Vice President of Program for the Wilder Foundation.
Proceed. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank Representative Erdahl for supporting this Bill HF1078 that supports the concept of creating a centralized fund. I'm at Wilder now in this wonderful role. I actually started my career here as an assistant attorney general. So I was a state of Minnesota employee for 10 years, representing this wonderful state on behalf of the citizens in two different areas. One was the consumer division and the charities division of the AG's office. And it was one of the highlights of my career, professional career. From there, I went to the University of Minnesota and served another 8 years, most of which was as the Director of Disability Services, which required me to help the university develop solutions very much like this one. During the time that I was at the AG's office and at the university, I served on the Supreme Court's task force on access court interpreter for the state, and had a guiding hand in creating the system that is now used in the court, which is very similar to the design of this particular bill. I cannot thank you enough for having the vision for creating a fund like this. I think it's critically important. Just a statistic for you of what I know is when the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed in 1990, the employment rate for deaf people in the United States compared to today, back to 1990 when the ADA was passed, the employment of rate of deaf people in the United States is lower than it was in 1990. So we have fewer deaf people employed today than we did in 1990, and than we did during the days when my parents were both gainfully and well-employed in the United States. And some of the reason for that is the disincentive of people to hire people with disabilities who create an ongoing cost to the employer. Deaf people, we're one of them. We add a lot of diversity and richness of experience and perspective to the workforce. I think my career attests to that. And I have been successful in my career because I've had bosses who have said, I want you. And I will do what it takes to get you on my team and to support you being on my team. And I have been graced with people who have been like that. But not everyone can have the courage to say, I want to make this hire, but I have a budget to worry about. What you would be doing with a centralized fund like this is releasing those who are less secure to make the right decision by saying, we have an insurance policy for you. And for all commissioners and agencies, this is a way to equalize the cost across the entire state. So if one agency doesn't hire anybody with a disability and another agency does, the one who does is rewarded. The one who doesn't, who pays into a fund, is going to be paying money into something for which they will not benefit from. So it creates the right incentive. What I'd also like to say is that in the University of Minnesota, it was a way to work to increase the participation of students with disabilities in colleges where there was an under-enrollment of students with disabilities by saying, you're investing in this centralized fund, you pay disability services to do this work for you, so let us support you to increase the diversity of your workforce. A couple of experiences, if you look at the Minnesota Supreme Court and its experience with a centralized fund for court interpreters for all language access to the courts, for foreign language interpreting as well as sign language interpreting, what we were able to do was also to distribute the skill set of people who had the abilities to supply the accommodation required throughout the state. So counties where there was a large number of immigrants who were Spanish-speaking, who may not have been investing in sign language or in spoken language interpreters for Spanish-speaking individuals in the court, were no longer disincentivized to create access because it was a fund to assure that everyone would have access to the court. It's a system that works well for another very important reason, and that is when you have a centralized fund, you create some expertise that allows you to manage the efficiency, the effectiveness, and the cost. One thing that I know is that sign language interpreters, when they contract individually, can set their own rates. And one of the things that the state can do is to be a very smart buyer of services for people who provide support services to people of varying types of disabilities. So this would be a way for you to save money by centralizing the cost, allow you to optimize the state's expertise, give you more buying power and coordination power, and will diversify your workforce with a richer set and array of people with disabilities. If I were to make one suggestion for this legislation, I know that you've just passed some amendments, it would be that this fund be focused on paying for accommodations that are incurred on an ongoing basis. So it's for people who have mostly sensory disabilities, sight, vision loss, where you have to have readers, it's on an ongoing basis. We have sign language interpreters, that's on an ongoing basis. If you need someone in the workplace to provide assistive services for you that are not covered by other government agency costs, those would be the type of costs that I would encourage that you focus on here in this central fund. I would also consider seeding the fund with some money that balances against the amendment to have it our agency contribute to the fund. The idea that you may seed it with some money to start with to really encourage the growth that we absolutely need to see in the workforce in the state of Minnesota. I've been a beneficiary of the state of Minnesota hiring me. It started me on a trajectory that has led me to be in this marvelous position as Vice President of Wilder Foundation. I head up all the programs and services for the foundation. And I got my start at the state of Minnesota. You brought me here from the lovely state of Wisconsin, and I've been a citizen of the state for over 25 years, raising two boys and a wonderful family. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Cordano. Any other testifiers on the bill, Chair Erdahl, that you're aware? Looks like we have one more. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you would, introduce yourself for the record and let us know who you represent.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is David Fenley. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Minnesota State Council on Disability. I'm here representing our executive director, Joan Wilshire. The State Council on Disability is a state agency that was established in 1973 to advise the state legislature, the governor, state agencies, and the public on disability issues. We have long been working on barriers to employment for people with disabilities and support this bill. Thank you, Representative Erdahl. As you know, Minnesota faces a worker shortage in coming years. The state will need to do all that it can to encourage employment and compete for the best employees. Making sure that the state is adequately budgeting for and providing accommodations to employees is an important step towards including more workers with disabilities in the state's labor force. Centralizing this function may lead to cost savings. It also sends a strong signal that the state is committed to hiring people with disabilities. The benefits employers receive from making workplace accommodations far outweigh the cost. Employers report that providing accommodations results in such benefits as retaining valuable employees, improving productivity and morale, reducing workers' compensation and training costs, and improving workforce diversity. Many times, these benefits were obtained with little investment. Employers reported that 57% of accommodations cost absolutely nothing to make, while the rest typically cost under $500. At the Council on Disability, the majority of our staff has a disability, some invisible and some significant. We have an accessible restroom at our office, and our office equipment is at an accessible height. from screens and keyboards that adjust to the employee who have mobility concerns, to halogen lights and noise-canceling headphones for employees with attention deficit disorder, accommodations can be a minimal cost. Alternatively, if we were to have the opportunity to hire a person who is deaf, deaf-blind, or hard of hearing, we would have great difficulty meeting the financial obligations to do so. Removing this initial cost to the agency eliminates any perception that it will be difficult to hire a person with a disability. We believe the benefits of hiring employees with disabilities far outweigh the costs. That is why the council supports this bill. Thank you, Chair and committee members.
Thank you for your testimony. Any member questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Erdahl, I like the bill. I understand the political realities around here, but I have concerns about the A2 amendment that we're not setting up a fund and starting out with money there that we're requiring them, because it kind of disincentivizes the departments to do this. But overall, I like the bill. It's a good idea having a sister-in-law who is deaf and hard of hearing, and nephew and grandnephews that are have the same issues. It's important that we get these people into the workplace and do what we can to accommodate them. But overall, I like the bill. Like I said, I just have concerns about the A2 amendment.
Any other Representative Pugh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have a question for our testifier, Ms. Cordano. Thank you, Ms. Cordano, for your just really inspiring and excellent testimony. I just so greatly appreciated it. I also appreciate your call to action to give consideration to what we might do as a body with regard to this fund. And so my question for you, given your experience, did you say at Wilder?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. My question for you, given your experience in the nonprofit sector as well as potentially in the private sector, I'm wondering what complementary funds and energies might be out there to given the potential for creating this fund for state agencies to draw from. I'm wondering what collaboration there might be between the nonprofit, the private sector, and this pool, if you will, of resources.
Ms. Cordano?
You have tapped into a question that I think I've been waiting to be asked for 25 years. So let me just start with what I think the model is that Minnesota could follow, that the nation is looking for leadership on this kind of question. Right now, the Americans with Disabilities Act places a burden individually on state employers and places of public accommodation, correct? So each entity has to pay. There is one exception in the ADA that we could all benefit to learn from, and that's with the FCC and the video relay interpreting model. So I don't know if you know or if you've noticed that on your telephone bill, everybody, all of us, each and every one of us pays the tax of a couple of pennies in order to assure that deaf people have video relay services available to them to use the telephone in the same way that all of you use your cell phone. So my cell phone is in my bag. I can pick that cell phone up and I can push my video relay company and I can make a relay call to anybody in the United States at any time. However, the only time I cannot use that service is when I'm in a meeting in the same room with the people I'm sitting with. So that's an FCC regulation. But the model is that it provides access by a shared contribution to a fund that if Minnesota were to model the corporate sector, the nonprofit sector, the citizenry, each one of us as taxpayers, and government, creating a fund that assures that deaf, I'm going to speak for deaf and hard of hearing people, that's really our, for deaf people to have access to civic life. In Finland, they have a very similar model where everyone pays taxes and they have a centralized fund and every deaf person gets a certain number of hours of interpreting services and they choose how they want to use those hours. But it would allow me to go to a funeral. Right now, I cannot go to a funeral without asking somebody to pay for an interpreter. So when my beloved physician, who saved my life 20 years ago, passed away, I wasn't going to ask his wife to pay for an interpreter for his service. The church, I'm not allowed to ask. And so it either sit in the service that was all in spoken English and mourn the loss of someone whom I cared for deeply, or pay for an interpreter myself. And I chose to sit in the service, and I understood about 50% of the service. So in a way, when you all mourn your friends and your community, you have access to civic life. It is what deaf people in this state are missing, is access to civic life. It's not just employment. It's not just access to places of accommodation. It really is about access to civic life. So if I were to say there is a pilot and a grand experiment for us to do in this state, it would be a partnership across sectors to create a pooled fund from which all of us could draw to provide for the cost of ongoing access to public events, to employment, to civic places of civic engagement like the legislature. And it would be something that we could do. And the FCC has a model that we could turn to. And it is one that is where you are leveraging the taxation system, where it is a place where you can bring all of the partners together to achieve something like this. It's a bold vision, but it's one that I've thought about for some time. And I would love to help any and all of you build something like that if you were so interested. We sure need something like that. And it would put Minnesota in the forefront of the country in terms of building a vision for increasing access for people with disabilities to civic life.
Thank you so much for your comments. And it is a bold vision, and I'm really, really excited about having a follow-up conversation with you.
Thank you. And if I may, I'm sorry, I want you to think back to 1973 when the federal government passed 504 and Section 504, and one of the things that it required was putting curb cuts in the sidewalk. Most of you are old enough to remember 1973, and if you remember all the newspaper articles that came out at the time, there was an outrage that we were putting curb cuts into sidewalks. And people thought, where are those people? Who are we doing this for? No one could even fathom that there were people they weren't seeing. But because it was the law, we put curb cuts in. And then all of a sudden now, we see people who are wheelchair users in our community, and they're part of the fabric of our world in a way they were not in 1973. And that's the kind of evolution I think I'm asking you to perpetuate with the vision I presented to you. So, thank you.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my question is of the author, but I just wanted to say, I mean, your skills are fantastic, so it's very, very impressive. Maybe you could just share with us, though, so in your experience, say, at the state, the interpreter services that you require, is that essentially a one-on-one, you know, if you're working 40 hours a week, is it an interpreter required 40 hours a week?
So I will describe for me what it looks like. I have a hearing loss where I'm profoundly deaf in one ear, and I have a little bit more than half of, about 65 to 70% decibel loss in my left ear, so use that as a percentage. Mm-hmm. So what it means is I do not have directional hearing, and I cannot always trust. If you know anybody else who's hard of hearing in your life, you know, I can't always trust that I've heard the right thing. So interpreters, for me, validate what I'm hearing. I do very well one-on-one. So I would say, and when I was working at the state and the Attorney General's office, I use interpreters primarily for meetings where there were three or more people present. Mm-hmm. I used it for negotiations with defending counsel and opposing and their client, whom I did not know, because I didn't know if I would be able to understand their voices when they came into town, because most of the time I was suing people in Texas and California and New York and other states that were bad actors in Minnesota. And for large meetings where there were training, that sort of thing. I have the ability to hear. I have the ability to speak for myself. There are deaf people who do not speak. My parents are examples of that. They are both deaf and remarkably accomplished professionals, but did not speak. Mm-hmm. And I have a nephew who's the same way. And there are people who have different types of hearing losses that affect them differently in different settings. And I would say that when I was at the Attorney General's office, what my experience was when I came in was, first, nobody even knew how to request an interpreter, so we had to figure out an administrative system to figure out how to request an interpreter. And then I spent every year reviewing the contract with the interpreter agency and dictating, suggesting terms and conditions that I thought were reasonable to meet my needs as an attorney, which was very different. I was the 17th deaf person in the deaf community to become an attorney in the U.S. in 1990. Now, after the Pratt Gallaudet protest, where all of a sudden law schools saw deaf people as civil rights-minded people, we have now over 300 deaf attorneys in the country. But in 1990, I was number 17 in the entire history of this country. We had a lot of learning to do about what it meant to provide interpreters in this setting, but we also had to find interpreters who had the skill set to be interpreting in the legal setting, and there were very few who had that. What I would say is right now my average use of interpreters is anywhere from 10 to 12 hours a week in my office. But I also have a job that requires me to meet a lot with groups of people, too. So, does that help?
Yes, yes. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Excellent. Seeing no further member questions, anyone else in the audience wishing to testify? Seeing none, Chair Erdahl will give you the closing remarks.
Thank you very, very much.
Just thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members. Appreciate the discussion. I think that this is an important issue that hopefully we can accommodate.
Thank you, Chair Erdahl. I will renew my motion that House File 1078 be referred to State Government Finance as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? House File 1078 is referred to State Government Finance as amended. Thank you, Chair Erdahl. Next on the agenda, House File 716, Representative Mahoney.
It's a lot of water here. I don't know. Did you take somebody's sweat?
Welcome to the committee, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Someone would be so kind as to move the bill. Hopefully you're going to send it to the floor.
I'll move the bill. Mr. Chair, I'll move House File 716 to go to the floor. Is that where it goes?
Representative Nelson, Representative Mahoney, we have a note here that this should make a stop in job growth and energy affordability. Does that sound right?
I'll move
all
it.
Good by me.
All right.
Move it to go there.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. Representative Nelson moves House File 716 to the Committee on Jobs and Energy. Representative Mahoney, welcome to the committee, and go ahead and proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'll give you a brief overview of the bill, and then I will turn it over for questions to one of the Port Authority employees, Lori Lauder. I always forget her title. I talk to her so often, I just, yeah, you're the one I'd always talk to. So anyhow, Section 1 allows the St. Paul Port Authority to file an assumed name. Basically, it's going to be called the St. Paul Port Authority rather than the Port Authority of St. Paul. That allows it to work with its partners a little bit better and create less confusion. Section 2 clears up the vacancy or the terms on the board, clarifying that it ends, the terms begin on August 1st and end on July 31st. Section 3 clarifies that the Port Authority cannot take lands owned by, controlled, or used by Ramsey County. I'm not sure what that all entails, but I always thought that was part of it, but I think this is just clarification. Section 4 clarifies that the port has jurisdiction within its port district, and the port district is its boundaries. Section 5 allows the port to work and provide services to any federal, state, or local government with written consent of that government unit. 6, it's more of a technical and clarifies how it can do work with small businesses that are in need of capital. Section 7 adds Ramsey County to the list of government units that the Port Authority may cooperate with using in the use of riverland. But for those who have been following, it does not add or subtract to anything that the port would do with the Mississippi Master Plan. Number 8 is this deletion provides for simplification and clarification of the name of the Port Authority in the bonding, wherein it does bonding. And Section 9 is a repealer. There's a lot of language here that was written up for me, but essentially it makes it simpler for it to go to the bond market without having to go to the St. Paul City Council every time. The board is made up of a variety of members of the St. Paul City Council, and it's in many respects a housekeeping bill for the Port Authority. I'll turn it over to Ms. Lori Lauder from the Port Authority to answer any questions that you might have.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, I'm Lori Lauder, Senior Vice President of Business and Intergovernmental Affairs at the St. Paul Port Authority, and I think Representative Mahoney has clearly outlined the bill. I would say that he's absolutely right in terms of this is housekeeping, technical changes. It will help us be nimbler, more fleet of foot as we work with our business customers.
Thank you. Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lauder, I wasn't paying much attention, and then I heard you could do things without the City Council. I'm thinking back a long time, and I'm wondering if it's still the case that the Port Authority is so separate that they can... the courts hold them as a separate entity as far as contracting. The case I'm thinking of is, I actually think, thankfully I was not the one in the law firm I was in that had the contract with St. Paul, and it was for an exclusive in the Riverview Park for a type of firm. And then the land was owned by, I think the HRA was considered the city, if I remember. And I don't know if you still have an HRA or if you've, how that works. And so then the Port Authority had one parcel in this great big area that there was a contract not to have. And the Port Authority then put in a competing business with the one that had a non-compete agreement with the city. Is that still able to happen?
Ms. Lauder.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mallory, I'm not familiar with that situation. I can tell you that the Port Authority was formed by the legislature in 1929, and we went operational in 1932. In the 60s, the legislature said, good work on managing your harbor. Now buy, you know, purchase industrial lands that are not performing to their maximum capacity. And so we did do that. We now today have 21 business centers with about 535 businesses in them, representing about 24,000 employees. I don't know the case of which you speak.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mallory.
I think the Port Authority of St. Paul does a very good job. I just don't like that... A lot of people would go in and get caught on something like that, just as the client did. They think that if the city owns all this property, and they view the Port Authority as kind of like that. So it's something to look into. I just, when you were talking about being distinguished on the bonding, I wondered if that still was the case, that people can get sucked in and kind of get taken by city or port authority acting as different people. But no, I think the Port Authority overall does a great job.
Great.
Ms. Lauder.
Thank you, Representative Mallory. I'm sure no business ever does no government ever is perfect, and I would love to see it, but I don't expect it, and I'm sure the port will take a look at it.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I just have, I'll start with a question about really a description of the Port Authority. You know, I think when most people, maybe myself included, maybe I shouldn't say that, but when I think of Port Authority, I think of the water and, you know, the ports. But what I think I heard, I'm looking in Subdivision 2, Section 1, to answer my own question. And so a Port Authority is a body politic and corporate. I'm not really sure what that means. With the right to sue, okay, that's fine. A Port Authority is a governmental subdivision, but really what, in layman's terms, what is the Port Authority? I'm thinking that you just spoke to the 21 properties that you manage, the 535, I think I wrote down, entities. You know, so really what is the Port Authority in layman's terms?
Ms. Lauder.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pugh, thank you. The Port Authority, I'll speak to our mission. The Port Authority we're representing in this bill be clarified to be a political subdivision. For example, that clarifies that, as one example, we are subject to audit by the state auditor. So it really does clarify the nomenclature there, if you will. Our mission is to assist business growth, primarily in the industrial sector, to generate business growth itself, economic activity, tax base, job creation, and so forth. We are, you're correct, Representative Pugh, we are beyond our harbor management. We still manage the harbor. We have over 300 well-paying jobs in the harbor. We have over 35 business customers that lease land from us along the river. A lot of them are employed daily in the global marketplace, sending product to the global marketplace, and we take exports in. In addition to that, we are known nationally for our brownfields work, which is to take fallow industrial properties that are primarily contaminated, that are not useful in the marketplace, and the private sector will not touch these properties because they can't pencil out a return on investment by putting all the investment in to make them clean and usable. So we do that, and we sell those properties to businesses. So that's where those numbers come from, Mr. Chair, in the 21 business centers. And then we also do financing. More recently, in the past 8 to 10 years, we have generated 3 different energy financing programs, which we are operating in St. Paul and outside of St. Paul as well. I hope that gives you a picture.
Follow-up, Representative Pugh.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my quick follow-up question is, what impact will this bill potentially have on taxpayers in St. Paul?
We think it will help, Mr. Chair. Representative Pugh, we think it will help the taxpayers. We are very customer focused. We are focused on business growth. We want to be very fleet of foot. We think we are already, but there are some improvements. Let me give you an example or two. The final two parts of this proposed bill are the repealers. The City of St. Paul agrees with us that as to the revenue bonds, there is no need to go to City Council because there is no general obligation of the Port Authority or the City on those. So it's more customer friendly for us to have our Board of Commissioners approve such finance without having to take the extra step, which takes more time. And the other part, of course, is transferring of employees. We think that's fairly arcane. We think it was put into law maybe 35, 40 years ago. And our employees we're small. We have about 19 people total. Our employees have different skill sets than those at city departments. So those are just a couple of examples, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Lauder. Representative Mahoney or Ms. Lauder, maybe could you provide some legislative intent here on first subdivision here, 1.12 to 1.14? What would be the purpose or the need for the ability to file one or more different certificates of assumed name? Could you just have a little background on that? Ms. Lauder.
Mr. Chair, a lot of times customers and organizations that we work with are kind of wondering what we have as far as abilities to help them. A couple of examples are we've done some consulting on brownfields with the city of Sartell after their fire and other cities, Moorhead and so forth. And then also with our energy financing, we have been working in other counties, Becker County and so forth. And some of them say, geez, St. Paul Port Authority, it would be so much more understandable to those of us in our community if you might call yourself something different for a particular program. So the DBA would be to file with the Secretary of State, maybe one example being energy. We might be known for that program in certain areas of the state as the Energy Efficiency Loan Group or Loan Corporation. So it really is for clarification of the different activities that we currently do and hope to do more of in the future.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is actually a follow-on to the Chair's question about lines 1.13 and 1.14. And it does say that you're identifying a couple other iterations in terms of what you would be known as, and Chair Sanders spoke to, you know, the purpose. What level of engagement with the regulatory bodies and or the identification of those other names, are we looking as a DBA type circumstance for the purpose of identifying a specific project as if you already identified, or I'm just curious in terms of how many names or the purpose for the names that you would use, is it to identify with focus or to shed some of the experience of the Port Authority as a name in the past, and you're wanting to move on. I'm just trying to understand how that would provide you additional flexibility.
Ms. Lauder.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, it's the former. It is to focus on certain activities that other entities may wish us to enter into. It's to reflect what we're doing and what we hope to do more of so that it's very clear. And it comes as a result of, as I mentioned, certain other entities saying, gee, you know, if you could just be sure that you can do energy financing, maybe you should be called Energy Financing Group or the Brownfields Expertise Group or something like that. So, Representative Albright, it would also be, as you mentioned, as an option, it would be for each program area. We really have a focused set of programs at the Port Authority. It's the harbor management for commerce. It is brownfields cleanup, of which we are considered to be experts, and it's various financing mechanisms. It's really basically those three things.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, hopefully this will be the last comment on this, and I can speak to what Ms. Lauder was referring to with the city of Sartell, since that's in my district, and she's referring to the previous mill site. And I know that the city and the Economic Development Authority and others in the area had reached out to different players across the state of Minnesota, including the Port Authority of St. Paul. And that is a question of St. Paul. Do you have jurisdiction? How do you work? What are the relationships that can be looked at when you're going through multiple kinds of arrangements or contracts or agreements? By changing the name to the St. Paul Port Authority, it's more of a business name than it identifies a community or geographic region. I think that that's what they're driving at, is the ability to have that flexibility to be able to enter into other partnerships or provide consultative services when asked.
Any final member questions? Seeing none, Representative Mahoney, any closing comments?
Good bill, vote for it.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Thank you, Ms. Lauder, as well. With that, Representative Nelson renews his motion that House File 716 be referred to the Job Growth and Energy Affordability Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? House File 716 is referred to Jobs. Thank you, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you,
Mayor. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and committee members.
Right. Next on the agenda is House File 1003 and Representative Lane. And we'll just turn the show over to you since you're on the committee.
All right. Thank you. I, because of amendment, I would like to add, I would move this to civil law.
Okay, Representative Lane moves House File 1003 to the Committee on Civil Law. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my fire chief in Columbia Heights asked for this change in the law to allow fire and police departments to donate equipment that is no longer serviceable to them and has minimal or no resale value. And we're going to add an amendment here, the A1 amendment. I would like to move this, which will allow that they can do this without liability claims coming back to the city.
Thank you, Representative Lane. The amendment is being passed out right now. And for the record, the chair will waive the time limit on the amendment rule so we can take up the A1. And Representative Lane moves the A1 as an author's amendment. And you can go ahead and speak to the amendment, and we will not vote on it until all the members have had a chance to take a look.
All right. Back in 2011, Representative Mack passed a House file that let public safety equipment be given from one municipality to another without having a tort claim, a claim against it. So this, since we're now allowing them to move things to nonprofits, we think it's a good idea to add that to this too. And we'll get more in discussion as we go on what we're kind of equipment we're talking about here and where it might be going. But at this point, we do just like to consider that a municipality would not have to worry about liability in this issue.
Thank you, Representative Lane. Members, have you had a chance to take a look at the A1? Any questions to the A1? Otherwise, we'll move to a vote to put the bill in the shape that the author would like. Seeing none, all in favor of the A1, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A1 is adopted.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's see. This situation could be as simple as cell phones being given to a domestic abuse shelter, but it could also be equipment that could go to a third world country where they could be assisted in setting up, for instance, a fire department. For instance, one example might be an old hose. You could cut off the brass ends and then sell this for scrap, but in fact there might be some service left in the hose, and this could be used in a department elsewhere. So I will get this over to my fire chief now, Gary Gorman, who will speak a little bit to this and then pass it on to the fire chief from Brooklyn Park.
Thank you, John. Chairman, members of the committee, we appreciate this opportunity to come today and talk about this bill. As you know, the fire service is a very unique business, and we have very unique equipment that is designed and built and has to be maintained to national standards just for the fire service. And because of this, the equipment does last a long time. Equipment does, it's built a lot tougher. So, and we don't necessarily wear out a lot of this equipment to the point where it has to just be thrown away. Standards change, national standards change, and we have to upgrade our equipment to these national standards over time. So we have all this equipment that is still usable, but it might not meet the current standards. We've all tried different things in our community. Years past, I remember the city always had a city auction for surplus equipment every year, and you'd throw fire hose and things like that in the city auction, and somebody, if they were smart, they were probably paid a couple bucks for the roll of hose, and like she said, you'd cut the ends off and sell it for scrap, and you make some money on your investment. Not a bad idea, but you know, that's kind of what was happening with it. Recent years, we use city websites, we use Craigslist, we, you know, things like that to try to sell this equipment if we can, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I've used the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association website and have put equipment out there for sale and even to give away, and that has worked with other fire departments, mostly in rural Minnesota, who don't have the capacity for some of this equipment to be able to buy some of this equipment, and it's still safe and still usable. So in some ways, I've donated some to that. I think it's a nice way to pay for it, other fire departments to use it. And that's what that previous legislation helped us be able to do. Now we have equipment that nobody has been interested in. And we've tried to give it away through the other fire departments, through the websites. And we believe it has a value. Obviously, value is a term that is kind of different with everybody. Like I said, there could be scrap value in some of the things that are all made of all metal. I suppose we could go out and scrap it, and now we've pretty much taken care of the city's case that we, you know, got rid of it that way. We are approached by nonprofit organizations who, especially from other countries, would love to have this equipment, who could use this equipment, and they don't have the oversight of national standards with OSHA and NIOSH and some of these other organizations that oversee us to stay strict with these standards. A couple examples. I have, and sitting in my station right now, 8 automatic defibrillators. They're 10 years old. 3 years into them, the company came and said, we're only going to service and provide support for 10 more or 7 more years on these. After that, we don't warranty them, we don't provide support, we don't service them, we have no parts or supplies for them. So when we get to that point, we buy new ones. Now I'm sitting with 8 automatic defibrillators. Some of them have never even been used or put on a person in the 10 years. I mean, they're basically brand new. Yet, I know there's organizations that would love to take these overseas in other countries where they're like gold over there because they're usable. And there's no resale market in the United States for them. We check those, and there's just no resale. Cell phones, another one. I think everybody here probably has a drawer at home where there's old cell phones sitting in them and don't know what to do with them. I have a drawer in my office with about 24 cell phones sitting in them. I'm sure my police department probably has double that in their drawer, and Public Works probably has, you know, in their drawers, where I know there's shelters and things that would love to have these cell phones for emergency 911 use, but we can't do anything with them. So that's why I went to Representative Lane and said, is there any way we can kind of change the law on this to see if it's something that would allow us to donate to nonprofit organizations? We don't like to give away stuff that isn't safe, you know, things that are going to hurt somebody. That's not our intent, you know. So this is all very usable, safe things, but they just don't meet the standards in the fire service at this time. What I'd like to do is Ken here is has his own organization, and I'd like to have him discuss that, because he's the one that kind of brought this to light to me in the first place a couple of years ago. And then all of a sudden, I found out I couldn't donate my stuff to his organization because of that. So,
just before we do that, would you just introduce yourself for the record, Chief, just before we move on?
I'm Gary Gorman. I'm the fire chief for City of Columbia Heights.
Excellent. Thank you, sir. And then welcome to the committee as well, sir, if you would just introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ken Prilliman. I'm the fire chief and emergency management director for the City of Brooklyn Park. I'm also the founder and president of Fire Rescue Alliance. Fire Rescue Alliance is a IRS chartered 501c3 nonprofit who was created specifically to build or rebuild fire service suppression, emergency medical, emergency management services on the continent of Africa. We have activities in 3 different countries. The most advanced is in the Republic of Liberia. As you may know, Brooklyn Park is home to more Liberians than any other city outside of the Republic. When we began and put our nonprofit together several years ago, the Republic of Liberia, a country the size of Ohio, had 1 working fire engine. They did not have a single set of gear, no helmet, no gloves. Our first deployment, we took a team over there, and we actually fought a fire in what we would consider a pretty large commercial structure, as well as what we would refer to as a quadplex here, a very large multifamily home. We fought that fire in street clothes. They had no gear, no protective equipment. As a fire chief in the City of Brooklyn Park, we interpret state statute that we do not have the authority to give away equipment, that it must, if it's got any value, it must be disposed of at auction. And as Chief Gorman has pointed out, that's not easy to do. It's cumbersome. Our core business is not selling equipment on eBay, and we're not good at that, and it's very challenging. I have, over the last 7 years, because of the combination of the limited statutory authority, I have actually cut gear up its seams and cut the sleeves and pants off so that no one would take it out of the dumpster and inadvertently use it and get hurt, particularly a child who thinks that they have found a firefighter suit and sets a fire. And so we are purposefully destroying equipment that has a use domestically and internationally. As the chair or the president of this nonprofit, we have seen firsthand the need for this equipment. There are many organizations here in this great state that do support fire departments in other parts of the state that have even older equipment still in service today. So some of what we did a few years ago in the municipality-to-municipality donation legislation in terms of limiting liability helped, but a drawer full of old cell phones has no use to another fire department. Fire hose that's already 10, 15, 20 years old will have no use, very little use here domestically, but it has a tremendous use in other parts of the world. This bill cleans up either the ambiguity or the lack of statutory authority that would allow a municipality to make a donation, and the amendment passes the same limit of liability to the municipality as they would if they were donating it to another municipality. We support this bill, and I think it solves a very urgent need. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your testimony. We have a couple member questions. Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Light, thank you for bringing this bill. This is a good bill. As a former mayor, I was astounded when we took a tour of the fire department and we saw turnout gear that was going to be decommissioned that I was told by our chief at the time was completely usable. They just couldn't keep it in service due to age or the number of patches that they had done that allowed it to be legally used. They told us at the time that they could have sent it off to places like Mexico was their particular destination that they wanted to send it to, where, much like you said, Chief Prilliman, that there were folks fighting fires in street clothes, and turnout gear is a fantastic piece of equipment that saves a firefighter from either grave bodily injury or just simple heat burns. And I think this is a good bill. I support this bill. Appreciate it being brought forth.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lane, I remember specifically asking you about, because I think I signed on to the bill and read it and signed on to the bill. And I asked about whether there was going to be any liability, and you said no issues. And you said no, and now you're adding it.
This is new.
Which now I am opposing the bill very strongly. And it's such a narrow thing that it's almost an impossibility. You have now picked words that are impossible to allow a suit. And somebody armed by something through gross negligence, through intentional negligence, even through intentionally allowing somebody to misunderstand it. Right now, I'm not saying the chief would do that, but he can now, some chief could donate this equipment knowing that there is a huge problem and danger to a person. And the way you have written, this is really, really, really bad language. I have practiced in the area of fraud. It is almost impossible to prove all nine elements of a traditional fraud case, which this is, what you're adding here. Intentional misrepresentation, adding the word intentional even makes it almost impossible to prove that. You now have a case where the chief could, or some chief could, donate this equipment and even know that it's there, and because they don't notify him, it's not fraud or intentional misrepresentation. We should get rid of this A1, and the people, if they're giving it out, could have a provision in the contract that they're giving that excludes any representation saying we do not make any representation regarding the qualities of this. They could do that. Then the other side would understand it. This is really bad language.
Representative Lane, I'd love you to briefly answer, but this will be something that we'll take up in civil law.
Right, and that's where it's going for civil law. So we'll have further discussion, but I will point out to the bill itself says that a local a municipality needs to do a policy of how they will do this, who's eligible and how they will handle this. So perhaps that's part of the further discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mullery.
That really doesn't help this situation at all. Right. I go from supporting the bill strongly, which I think the bill is needed. I think the amendment is really bad, and I hope you will strip it so that it is not, it really is a bad amendment.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also agree with Representative Lane and appreciate her bringing this forward. I like this so much. I'm a co-author, so I appreciate the opportunity to be able to be on here. Some days I wonder if one of the reasons I keep getting back on government, our government operations, is to find the kind of the nitpicky little things so we don't have to have bills coming back 3 or 4 years and saying, why didn't we do this one at that time? Representative Lane, I'm going to ask for your consideration that maybe we lay this over and do another amendment in our committee, because item line 1.9 talks about local governments means county, home rule, statutory city or town. There's a whole group that I think is missing in there, and that would be joint powers and or fire service districts that have been created that aren't by definition any one of those. That in a few years, I think we're going to get those folks coming back and saying we were missed in the law, and we can take care of fixing that. And then secondly, we're limiting it from the legislation that I see to emergency services, police, fire, and the like. There are also other departments within the community administration that may have computers or other kinds of things that might be able to be donated, and or public works with some of their kinds of things that may have common application as well. So maybe it's just a little bit more work. We can avoid having future hearings on this bill by incorporating those kinds of things. Again, I'm just asking you for your consideration. You're the bill's author, but those would be things I think that would help make it a stronger and cleaner piece of legislation for our cities, counties, and towns and other joint powers.
Mr. Chair, I would prefer to continue the conversation with Representative after this committee hearing.
Thank you, Representative Lane. Representative O'Driscoll, we have a few minutes left. If you would like to huddle with Ms. Dyson, maybe we have enough language that we could have a quick, brief discussion on it now while we do other member questions. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the question I had for Representative Lane, and it's is with the amendment that we put on, that is this similar language that was done in the municipal-to-municipal donation program that we passed a few years back? And maybe it's for maybe the question's for Ms. Dyson, although she's busy here. But it's my understanding that this is the same language as in the municipal-to-municipal, the tort liability part of that.
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, the language of the amendment mirrors the language that was adopted in 2011 for used public safety equipment that's donated by one municipality to another. And that subdivision in the tort liability statute reads, any tort claim against a municipality resulting from the use of public safety equipment donated by the municipality to another municipality, unless the claim is a direct result of fraud or intentional misrepresentation. So it's the same wording as was put in place for the donations between municipalities.
Thank you, Ms. Dyson. Representative Nelson.
So, Mr. Chair, I don't serve on the committee that it's going to, and but my understanding is that what the amendment does, and so the question that was brought up by Representative Mullery, we're just mirroring the language that we've already done. So I support the language, and I support the amendment. I mean, I don't want to see my city donate equipment and then something happens in Africa or Liberia or someplace else, and then they come back and sue the city and impact our budget because of something that we donated that was usable equipment that somebody inadvertently got hurt on.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick clarifying question, and a thank you to Representative O'Driscoll for catching that. So you're saying that if, let's say, the Southwest Metro Drug Task Force or the North Metro Drug Task Force had purchased equipment because they're a joint powers agreement, that they could donate it to another entity?
Representative O'Driscoll, Representative Joachim's asking you to yield for a question.
Mr. Chair, I will, and that's exactly what I'm looking at, is those different kinds of entities that may be in existence and may or may not be a question mark as to whether or not they're covered under here. I just want to take out any ambiguity so that we don't have to have questions and have those things be warehoused. And when I was bringing that up, I saw both chiefs nodding like, yeah, that's probably something we need to be looking at. So rest assured, members, Ms. Dyson and I are working as diligently as we can. If we don't get interrupted, we probably can get things done.
Representative Joachim.
Sorry, Representative O'Driscoll. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to clarify in my head so I knew, and I think that's a good addition.
Thank you. Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Sorry to interrupt Ms. Dyson, but so Representative O'Driscoll can criticize me roundly later for interrupting Ms. Dyson. Ms. Dyson, the language you say is the same as the municipal to municipal, and has it been challenged thus far?
Ms. Dyson, are you prepared to answer that question?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nash, I don't know.
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Continue. Any other member questions? Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment, if we could, from we've got several mayors and maybe other city council people here, but is there any possibility that what we'd be doing is setting up a faster, speedier equipment replacement schedule as a result of this? I mean, I know there's always pressure to have new equipment, and that's a budgetary burden, and will this be used in a way such as that? I don't know who wants to comment, but...
If any of the testifiers has one, otherwise Representative Nash, as a former mayor, also
I will just say that again, part of the bill is that the local government needs to adopt a policy on how they'll manage this.
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Runbeck, good question. Municipalities deal with future purchases with their capital improvement plan budget. So anything that is being replaced its replacement has already been budgeted for. There will be no acceleration of these items coming out. So every year when folks like Representative O'Driscoll, who's deep in thought, and Representative Joachim would sit in CIP meetings, we would actually talk about when to replace things, and only then would something be deemed surplus. So it's not going to accelerate the process. It's just going to be a positive upshot of the process being carried out, and we'll have surplus equipment that can then be donated straight away.
Okay. Any comments from the chiefs? Hold on, sir. Representative Runbeck.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just in terms of kind of boots on the ground, the statistic that the committee members may not be familiar with, but Minnesota ranks 47th in the nation in terms of its spending on fire departments. As a fire chief who's been in position almost a decade, we struggle to replace equipment at the national standard. Chief Gorman talked about the pressure that we're under to keep our equipment current. Most recent replacement included 2.5-inch hose across our entire department. Most of that hose was 5 to 8, some of it 12 and 15 years beyond its recommended life, which meant that we incurred some potential liability of using equipment beyond. I don't really believe that we would be very effective. I certainly respect the question, but I don't think the state would be very effective at using this bill to enhance their surplus. They would use this bill to clean out closets. And as the representative pointed out, I do like the local control that's included in this language. I would still have to convince my city council to have a policy that meets their expectations before I could do anything. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chief. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would agree with the chiefs, and I'm sure my fellow municipal experience representatives would echo. Ultimately, a city council is the last voice in what gets replaced in the CIP. We rely on folks like the chiefs here to come and tell us what does need to be replaced, and we make a decision based on that. And the chief is correct in that it is difficult to very often fund those things, and it's a great exercise for city councils to go through, because we want to provide the highest level of safety to our residents. So I don't I appreciate the question, but I don't see how it's going to accelerate anything. It actually is going to be a byproduct of the City Council having that control and making that decision.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we do have, through the diligent work of Ms. Dyson, some language that will help us deal with joint powers and kind of further define that. So, Mr. Chair, at your discretion, if you'd like to have Ms. Dyson review the proposed oral amendment for consideration by the author and the committee.
Ms. Dyson?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the proposed amendment on the bill would begin with on line 1.9, taking out the word or, and then after town, inserting or joint powers entity formed by any of these governmental units. And Mr. Chair, I'll write this up for the committee afterwards. But then the next part of the oral amendment is on line 1.12 with the definition of surplus equipment. The proposal is that surplus equipment means, and then inserting here, public safety equipment as defined in subdivision 24, equipment used by a local government public works department, and then continuing with cellular, so that it would encompass the public safety equipment that is in the that was added in 2011, and then it would also add in public works department's equipment.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. And just to give a quick example on that, the fire department, the police department, public works may do a group purchase of generators. And what segregates those generators if they're used for police and fire versus public works? They're all being used in some kind of a public need. And so this just says that those that were used for public works would not be excluded from safety equipment and the like. So because of the commonality of that. And I know that I've got others from local government experience who may want to comment on that as well, but we think that that does it.
Representative Lane, any initial comments?
I think it's good, and I would accept that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Nelson.
Just a question I have, and maybe this is for Ms. Dyson. And I'm this is a confusion in my mind. Town, is town the proper term, or should township be the proper term? And I guess that's the question I have in my mind. And I just want to make sure that for massaging the language, you get it right the first time.
Ms. Dyson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, you're right. There has been a back change over time. Town and township are often used interchangeably in the statutes. And so, town is the term preferred for referring to an organized town as opposed to the unorganized township area, the 6x6 square miles.
That's what I wanted to make sure of.
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Thank you, Ms. Dyson. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is for Ms. Dyson, too. Is there a, I just want to make sure, joint powers agreement, there's a specific definition of that within other statutes, right? So that people understand that it has to be I know joint powers agreements are set up in a certain way mm-hmm. to make them binding. So this covers that, right?
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, joint powers, and the amendment refers to a joint powers entity formed under it, but the statute's 471.59 covers what you do in a joint powers agreement or forming a joint powers entity. Yes.
Thank you. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also just want to thank Representative O'Driscoll, who is so savvy in this and many other arenas. I do represent the South Lake Minnetonka Police Department, which is a joint powers entity, as is the fire district that I represent. And the thought would not have crossed my mind had Representative O'Driscoll not brought this up. So I'm just delighted to take care of this right here so we don't have to waste any more time. This is a great bill. And I look forward to it passing. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Dyson, if you would you please read the oral amendment one more time? We don't seem to have any further discussion on it, and then we'll vote on the oral amendment, the O'Driscoll amendment.
Great. Mr. Chair and members, the oral amendment is on page 1, line 9, delete or, and after town, insert comma, or joint powers entity formed by any of these governmental units. Page 1, line 12, after means, insert
public safety equipment as defined in subdivision 24, comma, equipment used by a local government public works department, comma, and.
Thank you, Ms. Dyson. Members, any questions or concerns over the O'Driscoll oral amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the O'Driscoll amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Lane, I don't see any further member questions. We'll give you the closing comments on your House file as amended.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I will just say thank you for the opportunity to create this collaboratively together here to make it work better for all, and I appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Lane. Representative Lane renews her motion that House File 1003 be referred to Civil Law as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? House File 1003 is referred to its next committee. Thank you. Members, you do have a packet from Ms. Dyson in your folders. It deals with county offices. We're going to be taking this issue up on Thursday, so if you're not going to take it with you to read, would you please put it in the save portion of your file? With that, seeing no further discussion, this committee is adjourned.